Hi, everyone. Welcome to Podcast UFO for episode number 29. This is our second session with Chris Lambright, and today's subject is mostly pertaining to the Paul Benowitz case. You can like us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter. Those icons are right on our website. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show today. So I have Chris Lambright on Skype again. How are you doing for session two?
Oh, still here. Thank you.
Now, your book, we talked about last time, but we'll just, if someone's just listening to this segment, not the last one, your book is X Descending. It's found on your website, which is?
xdespublishing.com. But you can also find it on Amazon or on Apple's iBookstore.
A very interesting book, well written, about your account of all the in-depth research you've done. That, what did this take, 10 years of your time to do?
Well, the book certainly did. And of course, then it's all the years before that, just building, you know, and learning what was out there. Unfortunately, or rather fortunately, that's one of the benefits of time, is a lot of things came out. You know, Bill Moore gave his speech. Mm-hmm. Other things happened subsequent. Being able to track some of the research that Mirabeau has been working on, and looking at the notes, you know, the papers he cited of prior research, and then looking at some of the people that came afterwards who were now citing his research. And in particular, a lot of the information that went into that Appendix A about Richard Doty and John Lear, a lot of this stuff, if I'd had a time frame, you know, if I was under a crunch to finish it by a specific time, a lot of this may have been left out. I did have at least the advantage of being able to just finish when it got finished. So a lot of the stuff that's in there now, I think, would not have been in if I'd had to rush it. But yeah, it took a long time.
Yeah. And Richard Doty, what a character. It's hard to understand what to believe about Richard Doty. It's very interesting, that whole thing. Can you basically, in a nutshell, for the person out there that is listening that's never heard about the Benowitz case?
Yep, let's see. Okay, back in the... all of this takes place in the area of Albuquerque, New Mexico, to, let's say, the southern Colorado, northern New Mexico border area, particularly the western sides. And back in the late 70s, of course, the cattle mutilation phenomenon was a big thing in its own self, or mystery, if you want to call it that. And a lot of things were happening in that north western corner of New Mexico. Paul Benowitz was a scientist who owned Thunder Scientific, a company in Albuquerque, and they built, I think, humidity monitoring equipment and a number of other kinds of equipment, I believe. But so he was somebody with a very, very good reputation in the town. Their company had contracts with any number of military agencies, and he lived in a part of the town called the Four Hills, which is actually on the eastern edge of Albuquerque and practically right on the fence line to the border of the Kirtland Air Force Base and the larger Department of Energy Sandia Military Reservation area. But he got interested in, like many of us were, I think he'd been interested in the UFO phenomenon for any number of years, probably. But he had taken some interest in this whole idea of cattle mutilations and what might be going on, at least enough to attend one of the big Colorado Bureau of Investigation or whatnot conferences that they had back in 1979. And at one point, he met Gabe Valdez, who everybody would recognize the name Gabe Valdez as the state trooper, who in particular was responsible for the area that included the Jicarilla Indian Reservation, which is a large area near the town of Dulce, encompassing the Archuleta Mesa area right up there in northwestern New Mexico. But he met Gabe Valdez and decided to kind of just take a ride on one of Gabe Valdez's rounds one night. And this was, I believe, right toward the very end of July of 1979. And on that night ride, I mentioned some of it in the book and describe it, that he saw some very unusual things going on late that night. And the next day, went out with a Polaroid camera just to take a picture of where they'd been kind of the night before. And it shows some of the edge of the Archuleta Mesa and some trees and whatnot. When he got back to Albuquerque, from my understanding, it was his wife who pointed to that Polaroid, and there was an unusual kind of geometrically looking smaller object of some sort next to one of the pine trees in the foreground. And he thought that was very unusual, and it got him interested enough that in the next 6 months, between I think the next time may have been in October and possibly the very end or first part of November, December, he went back up there one time with his son, took some very unusual photographs and described some of it I describe in the book, things that he saw going on up there. But on his last trip, when he returned to Albuquerque, apparently his wife told him about some strange sound she had heard over the house that he lived in the night before. And, of course, this is an unusual, strange subject to begin with, so who can say how your thinking goes? But to him at the time, he thought, well, he wondered if what he'd been paying attention to up in the area of the Archuleta Mesa might somehow have taken note of him. But for one reason or another, he decided to stay up on the roof of his home late at night, just, you know, look around. From where his house was, up on the very rooftop, you've got a panoramic view of the entire area, 5 miles down the slope to the valley where Albuquerque is and the airport, straight south, look straight at the Manzano weapon storage area, which at the time was one of the most secure areas in the country, surrounded by a double or triple, I've heard sometimes, electrified fence. And it was on, I don't know if it may have been that very first night or one of the nights subsequent to that, he noted some unusual things seemed to be near the ground, way out there, apparently inside the fence line of the Manzano weapon storage area. And they would tend to glow every few minutes. And so he sat out there with his binoculars and whatnot, watched them. And suddenly, boom, these things took off, shoot straight up about 400 feet. Boom, go straight south and loop around the end of the mountain. There were apparently four of these objects that he saw, and of course it was a startling thing to him to see. Well, he saw this similar thing going on over the next few nights. I don't know if it was each consecutive night, but I know there seemed to be at least three, maybe four instances of this. And finally, he's up there with I think it was a Hasselblad camera that he had used when he was up in northern New Mexico, a Hasselblad camera with a 250-millimeter lens. He had some type of 8-millimeter camera, a simple Japanese model. I don't recall if there was a specific brand name on it. But he also had another 35-millimeter camera mounted on a telescope. So he was loaded for bear up on the roof of his house, observing these things. And at one point, he got out there early enough to see them come in and quickly land. He described them as coming in, and in less than 5 seconds, straight down, lights out. But he would watch these things, and it describes in the information I have as handwritten notes that he gave on legal-sized paper outlining all the details of his observation of these objects. His wife was out there with him at one point when he could finally tell her to get ready, here they go, because he began to could detect the sequence before they would lift off and leave. And he got a lot of this on film. I mean, and I've only seen a handful of images, the ones that are in the book, that were taken off of the film in his 8-millimeter camera. There must be some other very high-resolution images that were taken through the Hasselblad or through that telescope that I don't know that anybody's ever seen. At least I've never seen them shown anywhere. But it was when he went and had that film and he processed and he began to look at the film and he realized that he didn't recall ever having seen any kind of response out there on the Manzano weapon storage area. I mean, didn't seem that the alarms all went off. So he wondered whether the Air Force had any clue that these things were coming and going. So he calls the Air Force. And from what I can find, it had to have been in January of 1980. If you figure how long it would take to process, maybe given a few days or a week or two of him studying his own films. But there was a note, and all of this is documented in the book, in which Ernest Edwards had told two gentlemen from Sandia who had come and at the request of, I believe it was Senator Pete Harrison Schmidt, Harrison Schmidt's office. These gentlemen from Sandia had gone to talk to Edwards, and Edwards said, first contact with Paul Benowitz, January of 1980. Most people have believed to this day that Paul got his films in the middle of the year, like June 1980, somewhere in that range, about the same time frame when a lot of this other stuff was going on, when Doty's name came into the picture in the Kirtland documents. But in fact, Paul got those films, and I narrowed down when I think it occurred, even though if I was off by a week or two, you know, I don't think it would substantially change the situation. But Paul got those films at least in time for him to have contacted the Air Force in January of 1980. At that point, it was always a curious thing to me why we have no documents attesting to any of those very first calls or anything indicating anybody ever went and met Paul Benowitz, even though Richard Doty has stated that he went at one point and met Paul Benowitz at his office. There's no documentation indicating anything in about the first 5 months of the year. Everything seems to come out focusing right around the middle of the year. But needless to say, Paul got these films. He was able to look at what he had and study those films clearly enough to know he had something on film. I think it's obvious from looking at the pictures in the book. And everything seemed to grow out of that. Unfortunately, what seems to have occurred is somewhere by April or May of 1980, clearly he'd been talking to the Air Force for 4 months or so in here, at which point I'm almost certain he would have told them about his prior interest in the area of Archuleta Mesa and what he'd been doing and, you know, that sort of thing, what led him to be on the roof to begin with. And I have a feeling that was simply a convenient, you know, something to distract him, to get his attention back on that area. But somewhere by around April or May, whatever Paul's interests might have been to begin with, he was put in touch with a woman who claimed to have had some kind of abduction experience, you know, or whatnot. Leo Sprinkle got involved, and it was under hypnosis that where she claimed that she had seen some cow being abducted to begin with, it sounded like it was in the area of Archuleta Mesa and Dulce, and that seemed to have ratcheted Paul's interest back on that area, because what few people seem to realize now is the whole scenario of underground bases in the Dulce area, the Archuleta Mesa area, all of that ties directly to Paul Benowitz's having met this woman who claimed that she had seen some cow being abducted, and it sounded like it was in this area. And under hypnosis, she recounted what sounded like underground cavernous areas, and that's where the whole seed for the idea of underground bases at Dulce was planted. And it took Paul's attention straight back to that area, and obviously less so on the area around Manzano. But it also presented a whole lot of fodder for the idea of underground bases that if anybody went and checked, they would find no real evidence of. And it began to make Paul look like maybe he wasn't altogether, you know, there on what he was doing. But we don't know what he was being shown. And there have been some reports of helicopter flights up there. I was told of one by Ernest Edwards himself. I've got it on tape that there was a helicopter flight that went up to that area right after that meeting on the base with Paul Benowitz. And I have a suspicion, of course, that there was plenty being set up just to make Paul believe there was something going on up there. And he probably why wouldn't he have trusted the Air Force? You know, if you call them in good faith and they're supposed to be concerned and they're flying you up there in helicopters or they're telling you what they can tell you, and then Bill Moore comes in and you don't know that Bill Moore is being, you know, there's a circle of information being fed from you to Moore to Doty to back around, coming back to you, that seems to substantiate what you're doing, that I've often, to this day, I believe, you know, if you did not know that those people around you were working together to feed you information, how hard would it be to make you look unstable, to make you believe things that you wouldn't otherwise have, you know, have swallowed? But needless to say, my take on everything was to focus specifically on those original films, because when I first talked to Paul, as you asked me early on, a lot of what he was saying sounded bizarre. I mean, it was hard for me to comprehend how anybody could buy into this. And I began to realize that I don't think the Air Force would just invite somebody to a meeting on base if they were talking about ideas that had no evidentiary foundation to them. Why would you call somebody down with a meeting with a brigadier general and the head of the weapons lab? And it made no sense at all. So when I finally asked Paul, well, what did you ever call the Air Force about to begin with? And he said, oh, it was the first films that I took. And I'm like, what films were those? And that's when it all began to come together for me, that the only reason he ever called the Air Force was because he had these films of these vehicles coming and going from the Manzano weapons storage area. And that's, if you look at the documentation, almost all of it tends to focus on those specific films and then try to begin to diffuse the whole situation with other things being fed to, APRO at the time, you know, the Wetzel letter, a lot of other things coming into play, Bill Moore, the whole MJ-12 thing, which now books have been written on that. And I realize not only do people, not especially a lot of younger people, are not really familiar with the Binowitz case to begin with, but if you go look on the bookshelves and you find books about MJ-12 and all these sites written about this, and you don't realize that the first mention ever was about MJ-12 was in a document which is admittedly disinformation that was intended to be handed to Paul Binowitz. And it was where the Aquarius Telex and MJ-12 were first mentioned. But then suddenly 3 years later, I believe in the 83-84 timeframe, you have Bill Moore and Jamie Chanderay coming out with supposedly finding information on this roll of film they were sent with all of these MJ-12 documents, right, as though MJ-12 is taking off as a standalone issue in its own right.
Well, just like Delcy and you know, everything, there was so many things spawned out of this whole situation.
Yeah, and to me, that's the point. All of this information that spawned out of that is kind of the divide and conquer approach. You give something for everybody. If you're interested in conspiracy theories, well, there you go. There's MJ-12, there's the government. If you're interested in aliens, well, there's underground bases. Everybody begins to look a different way. In fact, I had to rewrite the chapters in the book that dealt with counterintelligence when I spoke with someone who used to be kind of intelligence, and at one point I just happened to be sitting there over a cup of coffee, and I said, you know, I don't understand why he calls them in January and nothing seems to happen until, you know, whenever, 8 months later. I said, we don't have any documentation from the Air Force. It's like they didn't do anything. And he looked at me and was just shaking his head. And he said, when you're in security in places like this, you have contingency plans. You don't sit around and wait until something happens and then try to decide what you're going to do. There would have been people in place. And of course, that eventually led me to find the book, which you can also buy on Amazon, written by the gentleman who used to be an AFOSI. And I used his own book to indicate how much pre-planning goes in to security situations to have something in place if something happens. My belief was when Paul called the Air Force and was put in touch with Doty or whomever else was there, and they knew that he had seen and filmed what was there, there was probably already some contingency plans on what do you do if you have a witness? How do you use them? How do you do this, that, the other? And perhaps they hoped Paul would just kind of go away. You know, he might lose interest if they, or maybe he would play ball with them and keep quiet. I don't know what happened that ultimately it came to what it did. But to me, it's the idea that now everybody thinks Paul was just somebody he thought there was aliens in underground bases. And if you look at the Kirtland incidents, well, there's a lot of things happening in around the middle of the year to later. Nobody seems to have any real clue that Paul by himself was on the roof of his house when he got those first films. And the Air Force did not have any idea that he was there before he called them.
Now, when you say the roof of his house, I was trying to picture this. Did he have like a deck outside of the roof of his house or something?
The Four Hills area is kind of a enclosed little, I guess I would term it the ritzy part of town, so to speak. There's even a Four Hills Country Club in that area. But if you go to to the road, Wagon Train Drive, I guess southeast, there's a white kind of community. And if you go to my website and look under the galleries, I've got some panoramic views. There's a map that shows the general area where all this is located. And one of the panoramic views I shot was from the White Wall, but it would show you that the whole area, you turn into this area where all of these houses are inside a big, like a one full block. The parking garages are around the outside. So there's a blacktop road that goes around the outside like a donut, and the sidewalks with the front doors are all on the inside loop. But think of this thing as one huge block of expensive homes, kind of the white adobe with a red brick little, you know, abutments on it. But apparently his is a two-story house with kind of an outside deck on the second floor. But if you get up on the top of the roof, it's flat.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding, that if you get up on the top of his roof, which I believe is where he had to have been, that he has pretty well a 360-degree panoramic view of the entire scene from the Manzanos all the way to the West Mesa on the opposite side. And it's funny because his house, about 5 miles from the airport, looks straight down the runway, as if a plane took off and didn't quite make it. It might very well hit right into that area. Puts him effectively a quarter of a mile or so from the northernmost part of the Manzano weapon storage area, which is about a 3-mile range that goes almost due north and south. So he had, from his place on top of his roof, almost a bird's eye straight across the plains above the fence and everything right to the Manzano weapon storage area. There's a picture in the book that shows that as well. So he had a very, very good view of things coming and going from there.
Now, his second floor laboratory that he had, he right away started making some type of electronic equipment that would detect any type of pulses and things like that. He started right away in suspicion that these things were generating electromagnetic pulses or something.
Well, that seems to be my understanding. I mean, I do want to say I've been to Paul's house. I just met him briefly, but I never was actually up in his upstairs office or lab study to really know what the layout of that was. But from my understanding and from what he described, it was after he took these films and he began to look at the films, and especially if I'm not mistaken, he noted at one point that the way they seemed to take off and move in synchrony almost made him believe obviously there must be some type of communication where they're able to synchronize their movements. And at that point, I think because of his knowledge with and of course he had Thunder Scientific, where I guess his lab, he could build what he needed down there as well. But I think nobody argues the idea that this guy was some kind of electronics genius. I mean, he could build what he needed to build. Greg Bishop makes some points about the equipment that Paul had in his lab as well. But he began to think, if these things are communicating and either they're modulating frequencies or whatever the case was, that he should be able to detect some of that. And he thought, if I can build some piece of equipment that's able to detect whatever unusual frequencies are going on, then it might be a way for him to detect either A, the presence of these vehicles, or at least B, something about how they're moving or communicating or whatnot. He began to build equipment to try to do that. And it seems very clear to me that he built that equipment after he had gotten these films and studied the films enough to kind of come up with an idea of how he might detect what was out there. The signals that he got on those films, and I think there's some reference in one of the documents where Jerry Miller himself says, well, it wasn't sure whether those signals might not have, could have come from anywhere if you were just looking at the tape, so to speak. But that's my understanding, that Paul was trying to build equipment that might be able to detect whatever types of frequencies were being emitted by these vehicles when they were in the area. Whether he was ultimately successful with that or not, I don't know.
Now, you yourself have been into computers very early on, and I noticed it somewhere in your book, I believe it was like 1980, he was supposedly given a computer. And what kind of computer would you have back then? It wouldn't do too much back in 1980. And what was, I know there was rumors about that computer that it was almost like spy software or something on it. But can you talk a little bit about that?
I can tell you what I know, but I will say, as I said to begin with, that most of my focus on Paul's work dealt with what came about in the first year, specifically around those films. The information about the computer, the first that I really heard that much specifics about where it came from or how it got to Paul, was something that Greg Bishop wrote about. And it seemed that, of course, understandably, Paul was pretty well off, so he very probably would have had the money to buy a computer of his own. Although back in the day, of course, I think there were just, you had pretty well TRS-80s, some of the early 80, 88 models, big floppy disks, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know those computers were available, so I don't really know specifically what kind of computer it was or whether he bought that computer himself, but the impression I got, or the understanding I got from what Greg Bishop said, was that the computer, and I would presume the computer and the software to go with it, had been given to Paul or was delivered to Paul by J. Allen Hynek at the request of the Air Force, but with a stipulation that Hynek not tell Paul Benowitz where the computer came from. Now, whether
have
it was
you heard that from anyone else? Because that seems awful bizarre.
It does, and I'm not saying that I believe it. Mm-hmm. Because I dislike the idea of something being said about someone who's no longer here to find out or argue with or to ask about it. So with Hynek not being around, it almost sounds like it's fair game to blame anything you want on Hynek. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So why it would have been necessary, it's very possible that if Paul was into this, and who's to say that Richard Doty or anyone else might not have come to Paul and said, we don't know how you're doing what you're doing, but tell you what, here's a computer and here's some software that you might be able to use to, you know, maybe he could write some programs of his own for all I know. But the concern I've got is if you're going to have a computer that's going to pick up some kind of signal, and especially if you're provided a computer with software intended to, you know, to help him communicate with the aliens, then you have to know what kind of signal that software is going to interpret.
Absolutely.
My friend Tommy Bland, who I've known for years and years, he and I got into this together, and he was there at the beginning of all of this Paul Benowitz stuff. He is very, very good friend. Was very good friends with Gabe Valdez, and is still friends with Valdez's sons. And apparently, Greg Valdez, one of Gabe Valdez's sons, of course, Gabe also had a lot of stuff that Paul Benowitz was giving to him and showing to him. And Greg Valdez actually had a photograph that I think looks very similar to one of the photographs that Paul Benowitz sent me. So I'm not the only one who has at least this one particular copy of the smaller object in the bluish spike. But we asked them about the computer information and what was there. And apparently they may still have some photographs of what might have been on the screen of Paul's little screen that showed that. But what I get the impression of is some of the early imagery may have been very rudimentary graphics. There was some reference to a computer game from years ago called Wagon Train or Wagons West, just some little tiny, you know, stick figure, very blocky graphics back in the day. So that some of what was coming across that screen at best may have been very, very rudimentary. Who knows what it was? But Tommy Bland said that he actually saw some of the pictures that had come off, and there were some bizarre things coming across that screen, images that, and I'm not saying I believe any of it, but the talk was he looking at some images that may have been projections from the past, because some of them showed dinosaur-looking, maybe reptilian-looking creatures. You see, to me, I think there's every reason to believe, especially if what Greg Bishop wrote was, in fact, in any way truthful, that somehow the Air Force got a computer or some software to Paul, that he was getting exactly what they were sending him, that they hoped and prayed he would tell everybody about, because it would seem so bizarre on the face of it that it immediately begins to make you step back from anything else Paul would have talked about. So I stayed away from a lot of that, because I agree that by the time in the mid-80s and Paul was, some of the things he was saying were just very, very hard to comprehend, you know. But once again, like that appendix about the small balls of light and the beams hitting them, that was one of the first things I'd say, well, let's get back to the films. You know, I want to talk about something else. And then you begin to realize, well, wait a minute, Linda Howe saw these marks. Other people documented these things. So I don't know what was going on, but clearly there were some very bizarre things happening in his home.
Right, right. Then John Lear gets into the picture, and there's all kinds of connections between John Lear and Doty, and this is all really interesting. You first think of John Lear, the reputation he has, you know, from his father inventing the Learjet, and he's such a decorated pilot himself. And it just kind of takes a whole twist back and forth between Lear and who goes to Benowitz's house. And this is kind of like ending toward the time that you're actually speaking with Benowitz, because something that happened between him and John Lear kind of made everything fall apart. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. My experience with John Lear came about through my friendship with Dale Gowdy, who was actually the founder of the Computer UFO Network. QFON, back up in Seattle, which is still maintained, I think, to this day by Jim Klotz. But at one point, there had been a challenge by Phil Klass to come to the National Press Club and show some of these Kirtland documents that had already come out by that time, because Klass was claiming it was all a hoax, you know, baloney, whatnot. And he challenged Dale, Phil said he would pay for the press club if Dale would go there and present them. And so Dale contacted me, and because he knew I was working on some of this, and said he's thinking of taking up the challenge. And it turned out that there was going to be a MUFON conference at that basically the same time in the Washington, D.C. area. And so he arranged with Phil to just have this, have a little press conference at the National Press Club. I think it was like on that Friday, if I recall the exact time frame. But anyway, right about that. So we'd get the same flights in and out of Washington and catch, you know, kill two birds with one stone. And just before all of this came about, Dale contacted me and said that he had been contacted by John Lear. And of course, all of us were like, wow, John Lear, you know, Lear jets. And so you did get, you get some mileage out of that name, that's for sure. But, and apparently John Lear had wanted to meet with Dale in Washington when we were there. Fine. I mean, that wasn't my call on any of it. But so we all end up in Washington, and there's John Lear, a very amiable guy. I mean, I will say to this day, he is a very, very likable person. And outside of any of this, probably an interesting guy with a lot of tales to tell. But he shows up in Washington. We all met. We were all friendly. Dale was there. I was there. Tommy Bland was there. And everything seemed very innocent at that point as, you know, we were preparing for the press club meeting. And sitting in the room, if memory serves me, there were some mentions made by John, who we thought knew nothing. We thought he was just, somehow he got interested in this and, you know, was all gung-ho now and had met Dale, and he had the wherewithal and the means to fly to Washington and whatnot. So that was fine. It was an, you know, open conference. But John began to mention some things about intelligence connection or something, some people he knew, some places like in Turkey that might know something. And I remembered Tom and I, we looked at each other and kind of, you know, raised eyebrows like, well, boy, this guy sounds like he's talking, he's not just a, you know, a clueless newbie, so to speak, that he, but all right, no problem. So we went to the press club, and it was kind of interesting. One of the points that I recall that I thought was strange was Tom and Dale, yeah, and I were up at the front behind the desk, and John sitting in the front row. The press room was a, you know, a room about, I'm guessing, maybe 20, 30 feet wide. You know, they have a number of these things, and maybe 35 feet deep, 30 feet deep, with a bunch of chairs in it. Some of the news cameras would set up along the periphery. John sat in the very front row, and just as it was about to start, I mean, seconds from everything starting up, John got up, moved, and sat at the very back row. I remembered to this day thinking, well, that was bizarre. You know, it was strange. I mean, the cameras weren't going to be focused on him anyway. But needless to say, he moved back, so the press club went off. It was fine. After that, we were sitting in, I think we were sitting in the lobby someplace, having a drink at the hotel, I believe. And I remember John sitting there, and at one point, he said, you know, if he was going to ask, he said, if I was going to make someone a spokesman for this, I'd pick Chris. And I thought, well, that's, you know, complimentary. That was fine. I'm not sure why that mattered. But he had this look on his face at the time. I thought, that's strange. When it all began to come about was when Bill Moore was giving a, I think he had a little question and answer session. And a lot of us were all, I mean, it was crowded. Of course, Bill Moore was in his heyday. And John was sitting right next to, well, on my left. And we're sitting here in these chairs, and Bill Moore is up behind the podium giving his talk and rather answering questions. And for some reason, suddenly, John stood up and said something to the effect, well, I know something about MJ-12. I know some people who know about MJ-12. And I mean, all cameras and faces were on John from that moment forward. And Tom and I are sitting there with this feeling of, holy cow. Hmm. We had no clue that he was going to do this. We had no clue that he was even had any knowledge of any of this stuff. As far as we knew, he'd pretty much, you know, just some guy who was had a name and got interested in UFOs, and he was there just tagging along. But all of a sudden, he stood up, and that was where John was born, as far as I'm concerned, in ufology. But I have to be honest with you, I felt seriously blindsided. Not that it had any real effect on me. It's just that I felt like, holy cow, I didn't see this coming at all. But needless to say, after that, you know, it's a fair free country, right? So John took off, and of course, all the attention was on him. And being John Lear, you know, he got a lot of notoriety for that. But we remained friends for a while after that. I mean, there was not necessarily any reason not to. And he was a very likable guy. He came to Dallas at one point and was giving a talk at one of the radio stations, and I picked him up. And you know, of course, I have to be honest with you, to be sitting on the other side of the glass and hear him say he thinks there's 80 species. I think that's the correct number. He said about 80 species of aliens visiting this planet. And I'm cringing. I'm thinking, trying to duck down as low as I can. Okay. That was John's presentation, as far as I was concerned, had to do with a lot of this kind of just way out there kind of information. I don't know anything really much. I wasn't involved with John at all back at the time, that although I'm hearing about it now, that back when Robert Lazar was first coming into the picture, John apparently was one of the first people that was got involved with Lazar without
quite that.
But John went on and made this huge play, you know, almost saying just about anything under the sun. He was one of the first real big proponents of things going on at Area 51, and he played up a lot of the whole idea of the underground bases with, you know, I describe much of this in the book, just in the section, trying to kind of clear the air on what I know of. But the point at which I had to just break off with even, you know, hanging with John, or so to speak, communicating with him, was one time when I was at John's house in Vegas. And there was a comment, we were talking about something. This guy's got an amazing house. I mean, had a, if I recall, a horse barn, had its own tennis court. I mean, we're talking more than I'll ever have. But beautiful place, beautiful room. You can actually find pictures online that show his study, which is practically as big as the average person's living room, you know, by 1.5 times. Pictures on the wall, the whole nine yards, and he had discussed some of how he had flown for Air America back in the day. There was a big wall picture that had, I think, the whole Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, you know, map, places he had been. But then he mentions the time that who was the guy that wrote Pale Rider? Anyway, had been talking about his time in the Navy and had been all over, you know, some of the things that he was talking about. And he mentioned having seen this bizarre document called the Krill Memo, K-R-I-L-L. You can find it online. And apparently the term that was given was O-H Krill, which John says stood for Original Hostage Krill. It apparently was some kind of a memo anonymously, you know, not signed by anybody, that seemed to attest to one of the aliens or some alien that had been captured and was kept captive for a while. Well, the guy, William Cooper, I think that's his name, William Cooper, who wrote Pale Rider, was a big name at the time, was in there and talking about having been in the Navy at the time, and made comment to the, it was a television interview, I think, that he was at John's house giving, and made a comment to the interview that he had seen the O.H. Krill memo back when he was in the Navy. And I may be paraphrasing this from my memory, but I'm willing to stand on this as being very accurate as far as the way things went. Well, he says to the interviewer that he saw this O.H. Krill memo. And John says, then they took a break. And during the break, John went over to Cooper and says, why are you telling him that you saw this memo? And Cooper says, well, I did. And John says, you can't have, because, and he names this other gentleman, because he and I made it up. And of course, I'm standing in John's house while he's telling me how this went down.
He's admitting this right to you.
Oh, yeah. And he says, Cooper says, well, I don't know why you're saying that, but I did see it. You know, something to save face, apparently. And I'm standing there, and of course, my jaw is starting to drop. And I'm like, I told John, I said, John, why are you telling me this? So you're telling me that you, I'm trying to recall the name of the gentleman that he, I think I've got it written down or someplace. But apparently, he says, well, this other person had wanted to, quote unquote, break into the UFO field. And so they created this document. Now, John has stated, and I believe it may have been on the Above Top Secret site, he's written some posts where he addresses this, that I've made this, I've said this before, that when I told John, I said, John, how am I supposed to be friends with you on this? How can I even associate with you when I'm trying so hard to have this taken seriously? And here you're telling, I don't even know why you're telling me this, but here you are telling me that you've fabricated this memo which is just more garbage out here. It's already full enough garbage as it is. Then here you are saying this. How can I associate with you knowing this? And that was the end of it. When I left, was, you know, that was all. Now, I'm not saying I don't like John. I'm just saying now, especially when I look back, and especially the type of thing that I finally began to, and I suspect now what I wrote in the appendix about the what I see as a very questionable Doty and Lear, I wonder about John's role in all of this. You know, whether I just don't know. John at some point can answer. He can address that himself. But the whole idea was for John to have told me he and this gentleman fabricated this in some way. I guess it was going to be a calling card for this person to break into the UFO lecture circuit or something. It was just unfathomable to me.
Right.
Anyway, but the point was, then after that, of course, John had gone, has gone on ever since and made a big name for himself as, you know, somebody who knows things about, you know, ufology and Area 51, and still, I guess he's still preaching the same story.
Now, he actually went to Benowitz's house and stayed possibly a couple of days. And this is like toward the end of your communication. And we need to wrap this up fairly quickly. But one of the things that happens is after John Lear leaves there, you have a conversation. He seems very angry about the whole situation. I don't know if he blames you or not. Changes his number. You're never able to get in touch with him. And in, was it 2003, I believe it is, he passes away. And it's kind of a mystery, but the question on his death, or nobody seems to really know that you've spoken with, how he actually died. But the question I wonder, is anyone trying to reach his wife, or perhaps a widow or other family members, his son, to see if there's still this information, his films and things like that available?
Not to my knowledge, other than the only last people that I have known of course, I think Greg Bishop may have tried to have some communication with him at the time, although I kind of agree with Greg Bishop from the point of view that, you know, they do have the right to be left alone. And I don't know what their, you know, the family side of this whole thing was and how they feel about it at the time. So I am extremely reticent to intrude, although I did call Paul's son while I was working on this book, hoping that I might clarify just some points of it. He was very polite. And even actually early on, before Paul passed away, I had called his son and just wanted to check on Paul and see if he was there. And because at the time, it was just staggering to me that Paul hadn't called me right away. Oh, and just to clarify, it was John Lear had been to see Paul. And after Lear left, I talked to Paul on the phone within a day or two, and Paul was livid about something to do with Lear. And it was subsequent to that, within another day or two after that, that Linda Howe called me and asked if I'd spoken with Paul. And I said, yeah, a couple of days ago. And she said, well, his phone number's been changed to an unlisted number. I never was in touch with Paul again, although I would have bet money he'll call me or write me within a few days, give me the new number. But I never heard from him again, so I don't know what happened there. But I did try to contact him. I wrote several letters after that. I have no way of knowing whether they ever got to him. I did call his son one time, who was very polite and basically just said all he could recommend was to keep trying, you know, to go to his father directly. And it was his father's choice whether he answered or not. And then I think after, while I was writing on the book, after his father had passed away, I did call Thunder Scientific and spoke briefly with his son again, but he basically just said, you know, they're just not interested in going on with it. And finally, the last thing I did just on a lark was just after I began to enhance the images and I began to realize that there is serious data in these images. I mean, you can actually get past all of this glow and see things down in there. And realizing how substantial they would be, not to mention the other images, you know, the Hasselblad with a 250-millimeter lens.
Right.
Where's that? And I did write to his wife and basically just said, you know, I'm just asking her that and telling her that my feeling is that those original films from his rooftop were the films that are at the core of everything. That if she's got them or if she knows where they are, to, if nothing else, please save them. You know, put them in a safe, lock them away, whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe at some point down the road, you know, somebody will have a chance to actually get their hands on the actual films. Because even Paul had told me when I was looking at the pictures that he sent to me, that he said the originals are far more clear And I imagine they have to be. What I got is pictures he snapped off of a film editor screen. So if it was possible to get the original film and scan that in, I can only imagine what might be in there, you know, in those original films. But I don't know of anybody that's ever got their hands on the original films out there. I guess I almost wish somebody would, if nothing else, so that they're out there or people can study them. But once again, it's 30 years ago, and it's tough to know. You know, I would like to see some justice done for Paul, at least for the fact that he did have something, and what happened to him, I don't think is anything anybody in this country would have expected or even imagined. That some people encounter intelligence or otherwise might make an effort out to defuse somebody who is simply trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, it's so twisted and unbelievable. It's a great book. It's a great read. It's called X Descending. You can find it on his website, xdeskpublishing.com. And Chris, it's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for these two sessions. I really appreciate all the hard work that you've done on this.
Well, thank you, Martin. I hope to talk to you again soon.
So this is Martin Willis with Chris Lambright, and that's it for today. Thank you for listening. I do have a couple of quick announcements. First of all our shows, you will see that we do have our shows transcribed. We also have links under the show notes. And we do incur some expenses because of this and other things. If you'd like to help us out, we do have a donation button on our sidebar. And $1 a show is all we ask. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.